Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This episode is brought to you by Winsun, a Taiwanese-American restaurant located in East Williamsburg, Brooklyn. Learn more at winsunbrooklyn.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Welcome to The Front Burner with Jimmy and Andrew, where we serve a weekly menu of industry commentary based on what the market has to offer. I'm Andrew Friedman from Tokeland.com.
I'm Jimmy Bradley from The Red Cat.
And I'd say we're delighted today, Jimmy.
Absolutely.
We have one of our favorite guests here, Amanda Cohen, who is the chef owner of Dirt Candy Restaurant in New York City. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
This is your third time with us, I think.
Yes.
And Amanda was one of
the...
It's a hat trick. Amanda was on our very first episode last year, and then on one of our Chef Council episodes this year, and we had tried to get her on in various contexts this season. It hadn't worked out. And we finally wrote as the end of the season was coming into sight and said, just pick a date and come in because we'd love to just have you here to kick around some stuff. So before we get into other things, how are things at Dirt Candy?
Well, we're still there. So that's the positive. We are still an all vegetable restaurant. We're still quite busy. We've seen a little bit downturn in the last 6 months or so in business. I think that has a little bit more to do with the world than with me. But we're still going strong. It's good. It's a good place.
Now I'm feeling remiss because I haven't gotten there. But you're doing your last one, I think, next week. You've been doing a beer haul.
Yes.
On Monday nights.
Yeah.
This is a Canadian thing.
It is. I am Canadian, so that makes sense.
Such a fun idea.
It's a good time to be Canadian.
It is pretty good. So
it's a nice card to have up your sleeve.
Next, just buy some real estate up there.
It's called the Great Canadian Beer Hall. It's something I've actually always wanted to do, but haven't had time or the money, really. I love watching hockey, and there is almost no bars in New York City where you can go watch hockey, Canadian hockey or any hockey whatsoever. And it's that's not fair. So years ago I thought, oh, it'd be really fun. We could do like a Canadian bar. We'd like serve Canadian food and we would show hockey. And then that idea fell by the wayside as I was working at my own restaurant. But then the election happened and it just seemed like everybody wanted to move to Canada, but nobody can move to Canada. So this was sort of like a little, vacation spot for them. Once a week, they could come to the restaurant and pretend they were in Canada.
And do people talk about that when they is Monday night a night where there's a lot of sort of political venting going on?
Actually, no. That's what makes
every,
it really
every
nice.
Other night.
Yeah, every other night. Well, two things happened. One, I did not know how many Canadians lived in New York City.
Serious
it is
business.
Crazy. Yeah. So it is full of Canadians every Monday night. And it just feels like a bar where you can get really good Canadian beer, which isn't something you can find readily in New York State, or at least not in New York City. So we have the only all-Canadian beer list anywhere in New York City, which is true for every other night of the week now because we have the beers.
Yeah.
And some Canadian food, and we watch hockey, and it just feels really relaxed and fun. There's a big picture of Justin Trudeau as soon as you walk in.
Always a good thing. Now, what about for this? So for you personally, is it nice to have all these Canadians in there? I would imagine that would be a special thing for you.
Yeah, it's pretty fun. And I got invited to the Maple Leaf Ball, which I didn't even know there was a Maple Leaf Ball.
What is the Maple Leaf Ball?
It's the Canadian Ball in New York City, run by the Canadian Council.
Now, are they your team, or are you have an allegiance to one team or
I probably the Maple Leafs. I mean, I'm from Toronto, so
sure.
The Leafs are my team.
No, I didn't really realize this kind of you know, corollary between like some people in the restaurant business and Canadian hockey until I met the fellows from Joe Beef. And then like even in their cookbook, like they have fierce allegiance.
Oh, yeah,
and then they
serious.
Talk about, you know, getting Riyadh up there and just getting them plastered and getting them to a game and then driving them to the airport and dropping them off. Like they have some really funny stories all centered around, you know, blowing off steam and their fierce allegiance to their team, which is what, the Canadians, I think?
Yeah, the Canadians. Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, we don't have a lot of, we're not quite like a sporty team country. So the hockey is where it's at. I guess baseball too, but.
Right.
So the last one is this coming Monday, which will be, what's today, the 6th, 7th, 8th,
the
10th.
Yeah.
Monday the 10th. So, and again, because this becomes a podcast after we air, Monday, April 10th, 2017.
But that's, we that's will restart it. That's the end of hockey season.
Yes.
So as soon as hockey season starts again in the fall,
we'll be back.
Yeah,
that's a sure thing.
For sure.
Okay.
I have neon sign, so I have to put it up.
is there something else that not takes its place, but another idea that you bring to fruition in the interim?
I need my Monday nights back.
Sure.
Okay. So we wanted to take a few minutes. And talk about, and we thought it might be interesting for people. I there's a lot about this I don't really know, to be honest, except for the things that are most common for what you guys do. But you know, this week in the Times, Bobo got re-reviewed. You know, I think the re-review was always a thing over the years. Chef friends of mine have said, "Help me write a letter to the so-and-so critic," you know, and I'm like, sure you want them to come, you know, like you never know. I mean, I remember years ago, Alfred Portali at the Gotham wanted a review from Sam Sifton so badly because he had been reviewed every few years, had always gotten 3 stars, 4 times had gotten 3 stars, and they were in the window, and he actually took the reviews down.
Yeah.
Because he wanted a new review. Like, that's how much he wanted it. But I always feel like it's a really dicey thing. I mean, you get this all this press. So anyway, this week, Bobo, which is a restaurant that I personally love, went to anonymously in a group maybe 3 years ago and had a pretty amazing dinner.
Yeah, I was there 3 weeks ago and had a fully amazing dinner.
You know, and lost a star, went from 3 to 2.
Yeah, but also, you know, to your point, that was an unsolicited one. You know, Mario's not writing letters to Pete Wells, hey, come check out Bobo,
yes,
you know.
For sure,
so
right?
It's a different one. Like,
right. I mean, I don't know. Do we know that?
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean,
why?
Intuition. Years and years and years of experience and knowing the players, and then
fine.
My best
so,
guess.
But what, can we just talk for a minute? I mean, what is the, I mean, Amanda, like with you, you know, you've had this restaurant for a while. It seems like you're doing relative to most people at the age of your restaurant,
right,
doing, you know, pretty well, good, nice following and, you know, fair amount of press still. But what's the level of, you know, interest in being critically evaluated at this point? Is it something that seems desirable, or is it something that seems like that could go either way?
Well, that's a tough one because I actually didn't get re-reviewed at the new place.
Yes.
So I'm still waiting. and I would like one. I would like one because I'd like to know sort of where we are in position to everywhere else in the city and how we're doing. And I like Pete Wells reviewing, so that means something to me. And in general, I agree with his reviews. And even if I don't, like, they're pretty close on to how I feel.
His thinking makes sense to you.
Yeah, it totally does. And what he also makes sense to me in how he reviews is he's not reviewing for me as a chef. He's reviewing for the people who read the newspaper. And that was a really sort of like eye-opening moment for me when I realized that. It's not like I go into a restaurant as a chef and I'm like highly critical. I don't go in as somebody who has to report back to, you know, the thousands and thousands of readers at the failing New York Times, right? So, I mean, to me, that's a professional, you know, critic's view of my restaurant. And then that lets me know what I need to do more. Do I need to, what I need to change, what I need to stick with, what's working and what's not working, where I'm not taking that only from online reviews or, you know, my parents. Right. We're like, it's a great restaurant.
Right.
Plus there's another thing, you know, to Amanda's point, listen, he writes the review, he's responsible for the words, but he doesn't dine alone and he listens to the people he's dining with. And those are your dining public, you know, those are the people that you're serving. So he'll come in, you know, usually a four top, usually three or four times, you know, at least two or three times.
And at least three, yeah.
There'll be different people almost every time. So, you know, this is to Amanda's point about, you know, being judged. You're being judged by the critic in the New York Times, but that person is influenced by the people that he's selected to dine with and that he's chosen to dine with and trusts. And they offer their voice, too. And that's technically the voice of your guest.
Yeah. I mean, Jimmy, you're what? You're about 11 years out from your last review?
Yeah, 11 years.
And that was, you had a one star initially, and then you got two stars?
Yeah, we opened in 99. We got our first review like 3 months after we opened, and we also were, it was a new critic, Bill Grimes, and we were his fourth review. And in the first four reviews, there was one two-star review and three one-star reviews. So we were in pretty good company. Chefs like Jonathan Waxman and Charlie Palmer pulled one star, so right. I didn't feel too bad about pulling
well,
one star.
Well, I've said this forever. Grimes, to me, mastered the one-star love letter.
Yeah.
Like, there were a lot of reviews in that era that were one-star reviews, and it was just, the one-star wasn't a negative. It was just, there was a, it's how much things, how fast things change.
Sure. Well,
because
you know,
it was about the level of lack of formality.
Right.
It wasn't about dissatisfaction at all.
He wanted to adjust the bar from Ruth as well, and I think that it was in the stars, not in the words, you know?
Right.
And then to our other point about re-reviews and so on. So I was never looking for a re-review. I never wrote a letter for a re-review. What happened was I started opening other restaurants, and one of the restaurants I owned was up for review and got a review. And at the same time, he circled back to the Red Cat, you know, anonymously. This is Frank Bruni at the time. And, you know, he gave us an amazing review. We never knew he was in the room at all. So
that's great.
Part of it is, it was really fulfilling, and this, you know,
well, it's great because it had a happy ending.
But listen, at the end of the day, if you're going to write the letter,
they didn't spot him at per se either.
If you're going to write the letter, it means you supremely believe in your staff and what you do, right?
Right.
But you know, who's to say that the letter's the defining moment? Like, don't you go to work and believe in what you do every day and feel like you do really good work every day? Like, yeah, you know, we're just people and we're going to make mistakes and we're going to screw it up for sure, you know?
Okay, well, this, I mean, go ahead.
Well, so I was just going to say, the other reason I would like to get re-reviewed, and I think this is probably for a lot, most people, is there's financial gains. As long as, you know, you do have to believe in yourself enough to say, oh, I'm either at the same level or I'm better. You are taking a big chance if, you know, you go down, if you lose a star. But when you do get re-reviewed, that's a huge financial boost. So yeah. I would take that in an instant.
Yeah. I mean, do you even feel like it would be a re-review, Amanda? Like
it should be a review.
No, I mean, the current place being...
It's a new space.
The current place being what it is. And for people who don't know, the original space was in the place that now houses Superiority Burger.
Yeah.
How many seats did you have when you were there?
18, or I could really squish in 25, but that was putting four people at a two top.
Got it. Right. So in this space is, you have, I mean, what, exponentially
seats,
more.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, not, it would almost not even be a re-review.
It shouldn't be. I mean, it is a totally different restaurant, and we were expecting to get reviewed from everywhere, and we actually didn't. The only review we got was from New York Magazine. No one else, like, big places came back in and reviewed us. To us, we're a totally different restaurant, but you know, we kept the name and we kept the concept, although lots of other places did the exact same thing and moved to bigger spaces and they got re-reviewed or reviewed.
Yeah. I mean, watch, and I'm sure Nobu will get a review, you know, in the next
Well, exactly.
4 months.
But then you internalize, and I'm like, well, maybe they did come in and they thought I sucked, and he's like saving me from a crappy review.
I don't know. In this day, that's how it always used to be, but in this day and age, I feel like they're even looking for the negative stuff to print.
So what's the, I mean, as much as you guys are comfortable talking about it, you know, there forever has been... industry is the wrong word because there's no money in it, although maybe somebody could make some money doing it. You know, the game of like spotting the critics, of being on the lookout for people. To what level has that been? Let's talk just generically in the industry. How good have people gotten at that?
I think really good. I mean, we don't look anymore because I just assume nobody's ever coming in.
Is that you mean that? You're not just joking?
I don't think, no, I'm being serious. I mean, we just...
You guys are just doing your thing and...
Yeah.
How about like a photo posted somewhere?
We have a book. We were given it by by somebody who worked for me and has the picture of every single critic in the city. And everybody studied it for the first 3 months.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's pretty serious.
Yeah, and you know, like... Okay, so I'm older. So that was all I knew, right? So
you what was all you knew? The photo?
Well, there's I'm starting to explain it. There's the old school method. So you have the aliases, you know, so you study the aliases that come off of the reservations or from the credit cards. The reservation name might be different than the name on the credit card. So you might be tracking two separate aliases. The reservation might be made, as I alluded to, he'll be dining with people that he respects. You might know some of those people, you know, you it's not that large of a community. He's not just dining with food writers. Right. He's dining with people that are in the food community, you know, and there's a chance that, you know, one of them might be your friend, but they, you know, you might just know of them or know them. So you're studying photographs, you're studying fictitious names, both in the reservation book and on the credit cards. You're studying phone numbers that go along with those names, and you're, you know, amassing it and putting it all together. But, I think the easiest cheat on the whole thing is, and the book is great, we all have the book, and every now and then, if I'm feeling it, I just take, you know, the best photograph I have and put it in the weight station. Because if you're looking at the photograph every day, yeah, the chances exactly. of you finding it, if it actually happens, are stronger than me saying, well, did you look at the book? Let's look at the book.
So what about, we've been talking almost exclusively in terms of the Times, right? What where does the Times fit in these days? I mean, there was a time when the Times, like, could put your lights out, right?
Right.
I mean, almost literally.
Yeah. Well, same thing with New York Magazine, too. You know, Gail had a pretty mighty pen.
Right. But I mean, what is it? I mean, there's so many outlets now that, I mean, I'm not even getting to yet, like the quote unquote civilian, like the Yelpers and all right. that. But the actual people who get paid to do this for a living, who have, you know, huge audiences, still the top.
It's the number one. Most, anywhere.
Most the one you want the most?
One I want the most.
The one that, like, career wise, like, yeah. that still means.
Yeah, in terms of reviews like that, yeah. absolutely. There is nobody bigger.
Yeah.
I mean, if I was in San Francisco, then it would be right. a different story. Michael but Carter. In New York City, this is it.
Then, yeah. And that, you know, that's short term and long term. There's a short term thing these days with, you know, social media and people who have a lot of followers. And they come in and they post some really nice things about you more than once, you know, certainly. It's helpful. It's a, you know, it's people are getting their news in all different areas, and then there's news and fake news. But, you know, in the sense of it, in this new media realm, you can get a pretty good pop from some short term shout outs.
And what?
So it's not only means me. I do think that Pete Wells is the. So the most sort of important food writer in the country because of his influence everywhere. There's right. nobody who has a greater influence than he does anywhere in the world. Like, that's how the New York Times doesn't think they're just a New York City paper, right? They write for the entire country.
Right.
And so he is writing these reviews for everybody to read.
True.
Yeah. That's and now writing reviews out. I mean, also right, these, like exactly. periodic.
And then it's read internationally. People read the paper internationally. These reviews are read everywhere.
Yeah.
So I don't know if it's the most widely distributed paper. That's probably very, you know, North American centric of me, but he sure. certainly is one of them.
Right. Well, and also now online. I mean, yeah. in terms of the reach, you look like you want to say something, Jimmy.
No. I was thinking about all the critics. I was a mental list.
I mean, my experience is that is the one that people, even just for their own personal, like, you know, checklist, what they want, that they want to talk, even younger shit.
It's feel a like big deal. It's a big deal. I just keep thinking of Jonathan Gold. I'm a fan. That's why I was going down the list. I was like, listen, and I wasn't going to say anything either. you read my mind.
I would die to have Jay Rayner come in from London, but sure. I mean, right. that's not the.
Yeah, I mean, I will say,
give you the bang that you want.
I can't even say what it was because now I'm friends with the person. But I one of the. When Jonathan Gold was at Gourmet, wrote
it was a pan.
Yeah.
And I literally spent about 3 hours one day calling five friends and reading them the review from top to bottom. It was, the writing was so amazing. It was so funny.
Yeah, fair enough.
Yeah, he at the Harrison, he gave me a review in Gourmet. He gave us a review in Gourmet. And I forget what it was. He was talking about flavors going together and making sense. And he said that it fit like a Tommy gun in a violin case. I was like, okay, anyway. You're getting a letter from me. That was outstanding.
But just to be clear, none of this is to dispute your point about influence, reach,
right.
and all that.
Yeah, no.
So what about the civilian critic? Can you guys tell when someone's like yelping at it? Can you tell from body language and whatever else, like what's going on, or when someone's like getting teeing up a some kind of Yelp action?
No, I don't. I mean, we don't see them do it in the dining room so much. So no, I mean, we've had people say, well, I'm going to write a Yelp review.
Right.
Like, okay,
well, I don't know.
So worry about that then.
What's that?
Then we're like, oh, okay, well, what can we do for you? I mean, then you try to like put out that fire as fast as possible.
Right.
Right. And like, who really gets behind fixing something when you lead with a threat?
Yeah.
You know? So again, I'll say it again. We're just people. We're going to fuck it up. There's like 30, 40, 50 of us each night doing the service, right? Then you add alcohol. Then you add perception and expectations. It's a difficult matrix to navigate. My thought is this. I'm gonna seek to give some advice here. For the people who write online reviews that are not favorable, should you choose to engage your server in management prior to being so disappointed you left and wrote a review, you're going to get much better results, period. Listen, I mean, I was taught this. If someone complains and says it to you, it means they care. The easiest thing in the world to do is I say, is everything all right? You say, yeah, yeah, it's no big deal, no problem. I'm never going to see you again, and I know it. I say everything was all right, and you're like, you suck, and you totally screwed that up. You've taken time out of your day to have an uncomfortable conversation with me. That only just means you care, and that only just makes me want to fix it. I mean, depending on the word you use, you know?
Right.
So for the people who are so disgusted that they have to leave and write about it, you're going to get a better experience, and you're going to get better results should you choose to engage the people in the building, because we're there for hospitality, and part of hospitality is exactly this.
Yeah, I mean, it's so true. I'm always like, I can't really fix the problem once you've left. So just tell me while you're there.
Yeah.
And I mean, there is this whole new world of people. So, I mean, we can tell when we're sort of hyper aware when people don't like their food. Because either they like love the food and they're licking the plate, or we're like, you can just tell there's just food still there. And we're like, this didn't go so well for anybody. And we are incredibly generous. Please don't come in and take advantage of us. but we will comp everything. We'll comp your meal. If I think that you just didn't have a good time at the restaurant, I'd rather give you your money back. And say,
so
hey,
your staff's trained to recognize those signs and make you aware of whoever's running in charge.
Yeah,
who's
absolutely.
In charge that night.
Absolutely. This is probably what we talk about most at our staff meetings every single day. You know, be aware, ask what's going on. If you get a, talk to the manager right away. So I'd rather, my idea of hospitality, and it's probably too much, is I want you to come in and have a good time. If you're not having a good time, I will fix that in any way possible. And sometimes it is, we comp the entire meal. The real assholes are the one when we comp the entire meal and then they still go write a bad review.
Do they mention that you comp the meal?
Sometimes. Yeah. Sometimes they don't. And you're like, ugh.
You know, we led into this whole thing talking about Mario. You know, I love, well, he's pretty active on Twitter.
Yeah.
And I've seen it more than once where someone's like, you know, I had a whatever meal at so-and-so place. And he always just writes back and say, did you ask to speak to a manager?
Well, exactly. Right.
Which is so obvious. But it is interesting,
well,
the cultural moment. You know, well, this is what, you know what, let's take a quick break because we're about halfway through and we'll pick up with this. We've been talking with Chef Amanda Cohen of Dirt Candy Restaurant in New York City. And we're going to pick up with this conversation with the Front Burner with Jimmy and Andrew comes right back.
This episode is brought to you by Winsun, a Taiwanese-American restaurant located in East Williamsburg, Brooklyn. Founded by Josh Koo and Chef Trig Brown, Winsun pays tribute to the myriad of flavors and influences of Taiwanese cuisine. They're serving Taiwanese food in their own local context, putting classic dishes like Lu Ru Fan next to new ones that showcase authentic ingredients, like noodles with shaved mullet roe, uitza, and fried chilies. The Village Voice calls the fried eggplant Winsun's sleeper hit, a Donnybrook of flavors tied together by rich, tangy yogurt. Other highlights of the menu are the Big Chicken Bun, their take on a fried chicken sandwich, or the Nutritious Sandwich with sugar-cured Virginia ham, pickled pineapples, and jalapenos. Is your mouth watering yet? You can feel good about what you're eating. All the meats on Winsun's menu are sourced from Heritage Foods USA. Winsun's beer list offers Taiwan beer, of course, but also a selection of local brews. Wine is available by the glass and bottle. On the cocktail side, don't miss the Chinha Colada, which mixes coconut cream, rum, cilantro, and basil. For dessert, they keep it simple with the ice cream sandwich, a take on the classic Taiwanese pairing of donuts and sweetened condensed milk. You'll want to order at least one for the table. To see the full menu and to learn more, visit winsunbrooklyn.com.
Welcome back to the Front Burner with Jimmy and Andrew. This sounds like a late night that jazzy saxophone.
Like your Tom Snyder coming in after that.
No, like one of those like music for lovers.
Go to bed, Andrew.
Okay, so we are again talking with Chef Amanda Cohen from Dirt Candy Restaurant in New York City. We were just talking about the full spectrum of people we might term reviewers or critics. This is the thing I wanted to ask you too, and Amanda, starting with you, obviously. I feel like, you know, the potential for those kind of, you know, that kind of online, I call it revenge. I don't know. I have to say, I have sometimes read reviews on Yelp or TripAdvisor. I don't spend a lot of time on those sites. Once in a while, I will find some, you know, just crazed enthusiasts with pictures and, you know, writing like love letters to restaurants. You know, but a lot of times I do feel like the negative ones, and Jimmy and I've had this talk publicly and privately, you know, it's revenge. I feel like it's revenge. I feel like there's very little motivation. You know, you go, you have a great dinner, you're off to the movies, sure, or you're off to a show, or you go home. You know, it's like you're fine. You have no, that's it. That's what a meal's supposed to be, right? It's the people who are dissatisfied, who, for whatever reason, are not comfortable engaging in the moment to try to correct it, which is what you both are strongly encouraging. But, you know, the thing to me that's so unfortunate is almost to a person, and it sounds like a cliche, you know, you ask people why they started cooking, you know, and some part of that conversation is, I like to make people happy. You know, I saw the response people had when I would cook. And, you know, there's a very pure motivation for a lot of people who are in the business you guys are in, which is a tough business, right? Yeah. And you generally do want to make people happy, you know, both what they're eating and the service and the whole experience. So this feels a little sad to me, like this moment that we're in sometimes where it does become sort of adversarial,
right?
And you're missing, you know, what Elvis Costello used to call the human touch, right? That it becomes, someone comes in, they have this interaction with the restaurant, and then they choose to, you know, respond to it, and even the compliment maybe doesn't come to you directly,
right?
You know, they choose to respond to it virtually or digitally, right? How's it? Is that accurate? Does it sometimes feel? It feels sad to me.
It does. It feels really disjointed. We're there for the customers.
Yeah.
So, and if they're not having a good time, I really do need them to tell me because I want to fix it. My goal as a restaurateur, I mean, I'm a chef, and so I have an ego. That's one thing. But I am also a restaurateur. I'm in the hospitality business. I want to make you have a good time. And to me, it's so much more important that you come in and have a good time than you like the food. That's like, liking the food is secondary to actually just coming and having a great time. If you've had a great time, you'll probably like the food, or you'll be like, oh, it's not my thing. That's okay. I don't understand why for now, like now everything's like, it's live or die. It's like, this was the worst meal I've ever had. I have to go talk about it. It's just a meal. You're going to eat again. It's okay. Nobody was out to punish you.
Yeah.
And because we're not getting that feedback, or people aren't feeling like they can talk about it just sort of like at the table or with their server, you feel crazy. I can be at Little Dirt Candy. I had to go into therapy over the reviews because I'd be like, I was at the table. I personally asked this one and I knew who every single table was. I was there every single night. I remembered them and I was like, I asked you and you just looked at me and lied and said, I loved it. And then the next day I'd read these reviews and I'd be like, how have we gone from having like being able to communicate with each other? It was crazy. I mean, I was like, I really had to like figure out how to deal with it.
Yeah, and what did you figure out? Still dealing with it.
Now I try to have other people read the reviews, and you know, I take the one nugget of truth from them, whether it's positive or negative.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know. Oh, anyway, Jimmy, go ahead, and then I'll.
Well, you know, I mean, if you're not saying it to us and you're saying it online, it's really hard for us to learn and grow and change from it. But also, you know, listen, if a business has. Okay, so there's an online platform. Let's say a business has 20 reviews on that platform. Let's say that 18 are, now let's say like 14 of them are great and a couple of them are medium and a couple of them are bad. You know, it's like taking a test. The audience that's reading those reviews has their grading system, you know? So if you have 20 reviews and two of them are horrible or four of them are horrible, there's a discount rate, you know, on that. And it's a little bit fascinating to me because... most people, when they come in and say, I read the reviews, only speak about the positive ones, right?
Yeah, nobody's like, I read the worst reviews and I'm still here.
But every now and then, somebody will say to me, oh, I read that thing about your thing and I had the thing and it's not what they said. And I'll be like, oh, that's kind of cool. Like, you actually read the negative part. And this is also, you know, my point about people set their own bar or they set their own way to grade things.
I mean, there is a... I suffer from, I think it's actually a huge problem, which is we are hyped and we are overhyped. And for 6 years when we had the small restaurant, you know, it was really, really hard to get in. And we get a lot of positive reviews and people read those positive reviews and they're so excited to come in. And then they come in and it's not for them. So then like all our negative reviews start off with, this restaurant is overhyped. Right. Don't believe the hype. I can't believe I came here, this hype. And I'm like, and it's really hard to explain to them, one, why do you, like, although I don't, I mean, our reviews are never that bad, so I don't think it hurts my business, but eventually you get enough bad reviews and you'll probably see a drop off in business. I'm like, so do you actually want to hurt my business? That's what they have to think about before they write these reviews. And also, hype isn't my fault. I'm cooking the same food. That's other people's perception.
It's perception, yeah.
Yeah. You know, I just had this thought. We're live, so I'll just throw it out there. But, you know, it is interesting. You know, the comment card is interesting. Because restaurants have had comment cards forever.
Right.
And the implication of a comment card is don't say anything until the experience is over. I mean, it is interesting. It's not public the way Yelp is. But I almost wonder if restaurants should say to people, you know, if there's any, you know, I don't know. I'm wondering if there's a way to message, you know, get that message across at the beginning of a meal. Like, let me know.
Right.
You know, if something's not
to your liking.
To your liking or... I don't know. And one way that invites people to sort of take advantage of you.
And one of the reasons I never, because I've worked at many restaurants with comment cards, and I never put them out at my restaurants, is I don't want people to analyze their meal.
I just want them to have the meal.
Yeah, have the meal.
Stay in the moment.
Exactly. And then walk away and be done.
Yeah.
But now everybody analyzes everything. And that's when you start to break something apart, of course you're going to find all the things you don't like. You're not taking it as a whole anymore. What's the whole experience?
Right. And, well, you know, I'm old, so we've been doing it since 99. We started with comment cards. We still use the comment cards, maybe because we buy them at $5,000 or $10,000 a piece. So we might not have used all of them. Since it's, you know, I placed the order five years ago. But I do read every one of them.
Right.
And, you know, for the most part, the people that leave comment cards, listen, there's two different kinds of guests, right? And that's about it. You know, we're throwing a show and this is the deal. So there's two different kinds of guests. There's the kind of guests that come for our show, and then there's the kind of guests that just comes to be served, right?
Yeah.
That's about it. So the ones that come to our show, you know how we know? They ask us questions. What's your favorite dish? You know, what's chef's specialty? Blah, blah, blah. How long you been here? The ones who want to be served, they're not interested in that. So you don't give them the full show. You give them the show that they're coming for. So in the comment card thing, you know, we probably get, I don't know, maybe 60 comment cards a week. But also I have this thing where if you write me a comment card, I'm going to write you back, you know, for real.
Yeah.
And I'm going to address whatever you wrote on the comment card that day, if not that week.
Yeah.
The majority of the comment cards that we receive are really very nice. And, you know, interestingly enough, it's not like they're analyzing their meal. It's weird, you know, and it may be just because we've been around for a while and, you know, people have settled into how they want to use us. But, you know, really, a lot of them are about the staff or about this experience. Like, this place doesn't look like a New York City restaurant, or, you know, Ian did this thing at the table and I wanted to bring it to your attention, or, you know, I do this other thing on the comment card. If you write your birth date on it, I send you a birthday card. You know,
you're so nice.
You know, so these were my little tools.
That's so you, Jimmy.
Yeah, well, it's me demonstrating that I have a desire to participate on as high of a level as
it's
I can.
The human touch,
and
right.
part
it's
of that
the human
is
interaction.
Being thoughtful.
Yes, I agree. I didn't mean it as a criticism of the comment card when I brought it up. I just meant it is interesting that there is this. That thing's existed as a concept forever.
Yeah.
And it does condition people maybe to hold their fire.
I mean, it might be somewhat of an archaic tool, but sometimes those tools work best.
No,
you know,
I'm
you
just
still
like,
see a
I'm
hoe in the garden.
I'm just trying to think of it from the other side of the fence.
But I think, I mean, okay, so now I'm like, oh, maybe I'll rethink comment cards. But
I'll give you some of mine.
I still think the guests who are negative aren't writing it on the comment cards, right? Like the ones who have like elite Yelpers and they're going to leave you a one star, they're probably not writing the comment card. They're like, oh, well, not enough people are going to see it.
Yeah, the real disturbed ones usually because they're still in the restaurant, right? And they wouldn't want that exchange.
Exactly.
But no, there's, you know, things like I found no value in your wine list or too many people came to my table, you know, like... things that I really think that I can learn from,
right.
Like whether I can do something about it or not is one thing. The timing is screwed up. Or, you know, like lately there's some funny ones like, you know, we ask everybody, you know, do you have dietary restrictions, allergies, blah, blah, blah. So we have a dish on the menu. It's salmon with panzanella and soppressata in the panzanella. So a couple of them come back and they're like, I didn't know soppressata was meat, you know. So now we say, you know, that dish has meat in it, right? So a couple of them are like, yeah, you asked me like three times to participate on a level and I didn't. And I had to send back my dish and screw you guys up. I was like, that's kind of, that's
I like
a little
that
bit
person.
Genuine. Yeah.
Okay, so we're down to our last 10 minutes or so here. We have to, and thank you in advance for indulging us, Amanda, because you are, I'm sure, talked out on this topic, but you are one of the, certainly, I think, most visible, most vocal proponents of a no tipping
right.
system. What do you call it? Do you call it no tipping? Do you call it
yeah,
service
call it no
included?
Tipping. No tipping. Just no tipping. I'm not fancy.
Yeah. So you, and we've touched on this on and off since we started doing this show. I mean, this is not, it's not a new idea. This
right.
is something people have tried on and off in this country to do for decades. Not a lot of people. It seems to have more critical mass might be too strong, but more people coming over to that side of it than ever before.
Right.
Last week we talked about it a little. Jimmy was sort of making the case for the traditional way. But what's, you know, what's your stump speech on this and what the arguments are for not having a tipping system?
Well, I take in all the money and I then get to distribute whatever money I have more equally between the front and back of house. We have really like non-existent slim margins at the restaurant. So I can't, like, there's just not enough money in my pocket to pay out my back of house money more if I don't do this system. I think that it's not fair to servers to not give them a guaranteed wage, you know, depending on what happens in the restaurant. Tonight's going to probably be rainy and I'm going to make them all come in and they're not going to make as much money. I feel like they should get paid for their time. It's a pretty sexist, misogynist system in general. And I don't want to participate in that.
How so?
People of color tend to get tipped less. Women tend to get tipped more, particularly if they're attractive. But they also get taken more advantage of. And then the whole reality with tipping.
And presumably are the implication is should maybe be acting in a certain manner.
Right,
or
exactly. The more flirty
or, right.
you are, you're sort of, you know, there's you look around in New York and you look at a lot of the sort of servers are still often hired for their looks. Like it makes me cringe when a server sends me their headshot. When they're applying for a job, I don't, you know, I'm going to hire you on your skill, not how you look.
Sure.
And yeah, I have a guy who's been with me for 12 years who needed to move on for one reason or another. And then I didn't have a slot for him. So I called up some friends and I said, I got a guy. And this new restaurant, very popular, really, really good restaurant. So I sent him there and they don't hire him. I was like, for 12 years.
Yeah, exactly.
12 years in the paint. And in one store, in one company. Like, name a server that stuck around in one company for
right.
12 years. Like,
that's
dedication,
good.
Loyalty, and knowledge and ability. And I was like, wow, looks looks over those four things? Like, I could never make that decision.
Okay, so...
And then, sorry, there's one more reality.
Yes, please.
Which is that tipping is actually sort of a false concept because nobody changes their tips. It's very rare that your tipping, how much you tip goes up or down. So we're just, we're faking it.
So you mean there's people who are like 15%ers, always. There are people who are 20%ers, yeah. And something would have to go extraordinarily well or really off the rails to take them outside that lane.
Exactly. And then the last problem with tipping is sort of part of a bigger issue, which is that we're tricking the guests into this whole system into thinking their meal is one price, and then we're just going to sort of make them pay a second price at the very end. And nobody wants to really pay what food is worth and what dining in a restaurant is worth. So... You know, it costs an extraordinarily high amount of money to dine in a restaurant in New York City for the most part. And then we're tricking them into thinking that it's not quite as high, but they are going to participate in sort of it by, like, you know, being my human resources department and paying the payroll for my servers, even though ultimately it all would have cost them the same.
But it's more than the restaurant business because that's everywhere. You know, you see Time Warner cable commercials. Yeah, well. You know, there's a bait and switch and no one's paying attention to it. Yeah, you get a discount airline ticket for this and then the bag costs this and then the seat costs this and then, you know. So, yeah, it's broad. It's a broad thing. I think the consumer is really, I spoke about this last week, is there's a disconnect between value and reality. You know, it's the Walmartification of America. Yeah, you can get it more cheaply somewhere else. But are you comparing real quality or the merits of the quality of the products? You know, are you comparing the merits of the quality of the service? You know, I think last week I said, yeah, you could buy pretty good lettuce at Walmart for cheaper than almost anywhere else. How respectful do you think Walmart's being to that farmer? You know, is that farmer doing it because they want to do it, or are they doing it because it's the only way they stay alive? You know, and part of the thing with the tipping thing is, if I had a brand new restaurant, I would really seriously evaluate everything I do differently, every single thing. But, like, you know, being 18 years old. And then throwing somewhere in between 20% and 30% onto prices, I don't know if I want my staff or myself to be fighting that battle right now. In terms of,
I think you're right.
The perception's really difficult. And like,
so you guys see each other's.
Yeah, no,
full merit, everything. Yeah, totally. Like, there is no right or wrong here. I think it's just your business's ability to get it done or not. And listen, you know, we know people that have walked it back. We know very successful people that have launched it and walked it back. In this point in my career, at this point in the restaurant, I have no desire to be walking anything back, knowing that I have to do it every... Like, I say this to my staff. Let's get really good at the black and white. So to me, the black and white is the fundamentals. Then I say, when the guests arrive, that'll be the gray area. So we have plenty of stuff to navigate every day that we're just figuring out by looking at you and talking to you. I don't need the dollar value to be part of it. And, you know, the other thing is we're a neighborhood joint. We've always been a neighborhood joint. We only ever wanted to be a neighborhood joint. You know, we leave 40% of our restaurant unbooked every night just for walk-ins, which is a ballsy thing to do, you know. So I can't necessarily justify interrupting the perception of that neighborhood joint and the value of the food and the service to defend a tipping policy.
You can't disturb the force.
My sense is that I would be carrying the hod.
Yeah.
I mean, we have to work really hard at it with customers.
This was my next question. There's an education on, like, a daily education that goes on.
It's the first thing we say to every customer when they walk in, to let you know.
It's on your website.
It's on the website.
It's explained on your website.
It's on the menu.
And, you know, so then you're saying, okay, so let's talk, like, for a while before you. So what do you like? What don't you like? What are you allergic to? What are you telling me? What are you not telling me? We tip, we don't tip. I feel bad about I'm asking the servers to go out there and recite, and then there's the specials, and so
where are you with the whole topic? Like, are you an optimist on this? Do you think it's still gaining? Do you think it's at a plateau right now?
I don't know. I think it's at a plateau. I think we'll see what's going to happen in the next couple of years. I mean, if I had tipping and minimum wage was going up like it's going up, I don't know what I would do. And wouldn't know how to be competitive with other people. I'm really lucky. Minimum wage going up isn't going to affect me because I don't have tipping. I already pay way above it for most of my employees. Actually, for all my employees. So I don't know how other restaurants are going to deal with that, except by then raising their prices and then the tip's going to go up. And I don't know how much consumers can stand. Like, right. I don't know how much they'll deal with.
That's a perfect point. And, you know, one of the ways I was thinking about it is I've seen in Tel Aviv and I've seen in California, there's a forced percentage right. at the bottom of the check. So I was kind of thinking like, well, look, if we're all going to do it, then we're all going to do it. And I'm going to be one of the first one to put my potatoes in, you know, so like, you're in Tel Aviv, there's a 4% surcharge for every guest on the bottom of the check for security reasons. And there's a guy with a wand, and you walk through a metal detector. You know, California basically says, you voted for Prop 8, now here's your 4%, you know? So
I will say the one thing that I learned. So we had an administrative fee, and then we went to totally no tipping. Ultimately, it was the same cost to me and mostly for the guest. People with those added percentages coming at the end, people did order more. So they're ordering about, I would say, like 2 cups of coffee less since we went full on no tipping. They hated it. They hated the admin fee more than anything. They loved the no tipping. Guests couldn't care less. I mean, every once in a while, there's one person who's like, sure. Oh, this sucks. But by and large, they're really behind it. They love it. When we had the admin fee and it was at 20%, you know, to cover the cost of the restaurant, but there is no tipping on top of that. Guests were so angry. They were like, that's just a tip. I don't understand why you do it. Just include it in the cost. This is awful. So,
it's that perception thing again.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't know how many words I can use during your meal to defend
you
our
know,
position.
The best thing, I don't think I've ever had a chance to mention it on air, but we did 2 pilots for this show. And one of them we did an interview with, or I did, went and did an interview with Barry Wine, who had the Quilted Giraffe, right. and advocated a no-tipping yeah, policy totally. There. And Barry had this... example he gave me, which is they had this very famous dish called beggar's purses, where the so if somebody ordered 5 of those, I forget if it was $50 or $75, but someone would have to make a in the kitchen they'd make a crepe, and then they'd put the caviar and the creme fraiche inside, and then they'd pull it up, and then they'd tie it with a chive, and they had to do 5 of those, and that's a lot of work, right? And that cook didn't make an extra penny for that, and the server who carried it from the kitchen to right. to the table made an extra couple of bucks, right? And I always found that very persuasive. Anyway, that's going to be the last word. I'm sorry, Jimmy. I'm sorry.
Quite all right.
I'm sorry. Listen, before we thank Amanda, I'm going out of sequence because we're really excited. We have a special edition of the show coming up. It's if you subscribe to the show, it'll just drop into your feed. I'm not trying to make you subscribe to the show, but that it's not going to run in our regular slot, so it might be the best way to get it. Otherwise, it'll be in rotation on other times at Heritage. But Jeremiah Tower, the great California chef, although that's really making it much too narrow, who had Stars Restaurant, and before that was at Chez Panisse. There's a new documentary about him that's coming out in a couple of weeks. The documentary was executive produced by Tony Bourdain. It was directed by Lydia Tenaglia, who is also one of the founders of 0.0.
Yeah, it's called The Last Magnificent.
It is called The Last Magnificent. And when that movie premiered at the Tribeca Film Festival last year, we were lucky enough to spend an hour with Jeremiah, Tony, and Lydia talking about the movie and Jeremiah's career. And that's going to debut as a special report in about a week and a half. And we're really excited about that. And then our last show of the season, we don't know who our second guest will be, but we're going to have a live interview with Chef Barbara Lynch from Boston, who has a new memoir that's great. And that I think it's just coming out. So everybody should order that. And that's what's coming up. And with that, Amanda Cohen of Dirt Candy, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Please support Dirt Candy if you live in New York or you're visiting New York or you're Canadian or you're not Canadian or... I guess you should probably like vegetables.
Yeah, we did have somebody come in the other day who said they were allergic to all vegetables. I was like, well, that's going to be a problem.
That's
isn't
a problem.
It?
There's the door. And with that, I'm Andrew Friedman from Tokeland.com.
I'm Jimmy Bradley from The Right Cat.
And we'll see you back here soon on The Front Burner with Jimmy and Andrew. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awaili, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.
Listening.